Thank Crunchy, it's Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed on your radio today.
It is the truth of our lives in our society in Ireland that domestic violence is still a far too hidden and far too endemic issue in our society.
I'd imagine it was used for a gender reveal.
What?
There seems to be a bunch of pink doves just sitting on the roof of a house somewhere in the west of Ireland.
So you are the headstanding granny?
Not yet headstanding, but on the way. The journey has started. I'm 3 weeks into it.
And let's start here in the afternoon on the live line and pink doves. Yes, pink doves.
An eagle-eyed listener, pardon the pun, spotted a flock of doves on a roof in Roscommon this week, but nothing unusual there except all the doves were pink. And we tweeted the photograph and she is baffled as to how you can have pink doves. Anthony Corbett works for Wedding Doves Ireland. I think he is Wedding Doves Ireland. Have you ever heard of a pink dove, Anthony?
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good, yeah.
Thanks for inviting me onto your show. Yeah, I just got a call from one of your colleagues earlier on, and I've seen that photograph in particular. I'd imagine it was used for a gender reveal.
What?
There seems to be a bunch of pink doves just sitting on the roof of a house somewhere in the west of Ireland.
And how are they used in a gender reveal?
Gender reveals are basically used by couples who want to reveal the gender of the baby.
Yeah.
And this is the first time I've seen this. And to be honest with you, it's a bit disingenuous to dye in that colour, you know.
So hang on.
It gives a bad impression for all wedding dove release specialists around the country.
So you're saying I go to the party under the COVID regulation. 250 for the rest of us, 200. No, none for the rest of us. Anyway, we're outdoors. And you can have a musician from 12 o'clock today. But gender reveal, I say 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, I'm pregnant, or we're pregnant, as they say. And they release, they pull open this box and the doves fly out. And whatever colour the doves are is the gender, pink for a girl, blue for a boy, is it?
Yeah, that must have been what happened. It's a bit weird because I got a call the other day. I was actually doing a wedding in Blanchardstown, releasing some doves, and I got a call from a lady from the west of Ireland inquiring, "Do I dye my doves?" So I'd imagine that she was looking to dye some, and I told her it's under no circumstances would I be dyeing any of my doves for several reasons, and two, basically, one, because the birds of prey that we have around at the moment would target these doves.
Okay.
And also, basically, because the doves would stay pink or stay blue or whatever colour they were dyed until they molted out the following year. They molted out their new feathers the following year. So it would be a bit cruel to have them like that all throughout the year.
But what, like, would a dove die if you dyed a dove?
I'd imagine it was food colouring that was used to dye these doves. Yeah, there's several photos online of different people, not only in Ireland, but around Europe, dyeing their doves. And some of them look spectacular, but also, like, some of them are a bit dawdy looking, to be honest with you, and it's not right, in my opinion.
Anthony there, and then Pat Fallon, magician, was talking to Joe.
Pat, do you use doves in your act?
Yes, indeed, Joe, I do. I've been using doves for over 25 years now.
And would you dye a dove?
I have in the past. I was asked as a product launch for a jean company that were going coloured rather than the blue.
Mm-hmm.
And I dyed them and kept them like that for a few years. But then I went back to the natural white, you know, traditional.
And is there any other way you can change the colour of the dove without dyeing the dove?
Well, not really. I mean, the dyeing process is quite simple because it is, as your previous caller said, it's food colouring. And you put it in, and they do have to molt out, so it means you have to do them, you know, almost twice a year to keep them that colour. But it doesn't do them any harm. I mean, it's food colouring, that's why we use it. It's not poisonous or anything like that, you know.
But is there any dove that's indigenously pink? Do you follow me?
Not that I know of. Now, there's a difference between the type of doves that I use and the types of doves that are you know, used at weddings and things, because mine won't actually survive outdoors because they're like, they're white Java doves and they're more like a canary, or, you know, and that sort of cage bird breed.
Mm-hmm. And what about if you feed a dove a different food, can you change the colour of the dove?
Not that I know of, Joe. I mean, I've no experience in that. I mean, magicians traditionally would dye their doves using food colouring. But it was a fad in the 60s and 70s, really, and I wouldn't have done it only for the, you know, this product launch was part of the contract. You know, it sort of went out of fashion. It's like so many other things. But I'm not aware of this gender thing at all because it's sort of different from my business, you know.
And Anthony, have you heard of doves being fed a different diet to get them to go a different colour?
No, Joe, to be honest. Although I've seen guys with canaries and they'd feed them a different type of food when they're young and when the feathers are grown to accentuate some of the oranges and the yellows that the canary breeders would breed.
Oh, do you? So what do you feed them? Oranges?
It wouldn't be oranges. It would be, it'd be a certain food additive. That, you know, a small board breeder would be able to tell you more than I would here.
Okay.
Because I don't know.
Apparently, they're a rare breed called pink pigeons, but they're now an endangered species in Mauritius, and they're the only, as far as I can find out now, they're the only living relative that has any connection with the dodo.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I think there's obviously a dead dodo in the Natural History Museum, the dead zoo in Merrion Square. Would racing club would I dye my dove, or indeed my pigeon or any bird to make it more identifiable, say in a race?
I personally wouldn't do that, and I know of a lot of pigeon fanciers who do race, and they wouldn't do that either. Basically, because that would make the bird a target for birds of prey. That bird would stick out like a sore thumb in a flock of pigeons flying home. That's the reason why a lot of the pigeon fanciers and the pigeon racers wouldn't use white pigeons to race.
Okay.
Because they tend to stick out in a large flock, and they would be targeted on the way home from a race.
And Joe asked Anthony if anyone asks for doves at funerals.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
But are they white or black doves? There's no such thing as a black dove.
Well, you can get black pigeons. The birds I use, Joe, would be actually small racing pigeons because it would be unethical to use small magician's doves as outlined by a previous caller
when they're let out of the grave or a wedding or a grave or whatever, I presume they fly back to you. So they're homing pigeons of a sort.
They do fly home. They do fly home. We started this about 11 years ago, and I think we've only lost 4 doves in all of that time.
Wow.
And they do travel from all over the country. We actually have some going to Sligo in the morning, funeral.
A funeral?
Yeah, we've 13. We have a family member coming over to collect them in the morning, and they're going to bring them over to Sligo, and the birds should be home to me by 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
But do people look for, when they're ordering doves for a funeral, do they look for, say, the person who died was 65, I want 65 doves?
No. Usually it's more symbolic than that, Joe. They would ask for, say, doves for the amount of children that that person might have had, or they might just want the one single dove, or they might want up to maybe 10 doves. But not for, it's not age-related,
unless
the person died just pretty young.
Oh, God.
That's Anthony. Then Joe Dunn called.
This only came to my attention a couple of weeks ago when there was a bit of an outcry on Facebook about the release of these doves, because they don't survive in the wild, according to research and the feedback that we were getting, you know.
Yeah, so would you go to a wedding? If you went to a wedding and outside the church, the doves were released, would you go to the reception?
Joe, you go to the wedding and you don't really know what's going to happen, you know, but if the doves are being released at a wedding, you're not going to make a hullabaloo at the wedding, you know, but you would sort of make your opinions known about it, you know.
And if you had a say in it beforehand, you'd say, no, don't.
Anthony,
they don't survive in the wild. That's according to Facebook, if you believe Facebook. But Anthony.
Well, the doves themselves don't survive in the wild, Joe, but feral pigeons can survive in the wild.
Yeah.
Although the birds that we use would be small white racing pigeons. They wouldn't be feral at all.
And how many have you lost again in the...
I've lost 4, Joe, in 10 years.
That's a pretty low attrition rate, isn't it, Joe?
Yeah,
Dunn?
they make their way home. They're good racing pigeons. I actually travelled to Belgium 10 years ago to source some of the best racing pigeons in Europe. Yeah. So to ensure that I don't have many losses.
So, Joe, what do you think of that? It's only four nutrition rate of, I presume, I don't know what that percentage is, but surely less than in the wild.
Yeah, well, I'm not an expert on it, Joe, you know, but I'm only going on what the outcry on Facebook was about, the doves don't survive. Pigeons will survive. The pigeons will come back.
Yeah, well, Anthony's explained it, in fairness. They look like doves, but they're actually young pigeons.
Then Betty calls.
Betty Mitchell. Betty, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. Dove stories. Where dove stories begin?
Greece. A place called Altea. And over the Easter period, as you know, their Easter follows after our Easter.
Yeah, the difference.
In the Orthodox Church. Yeah. But the Easter Sunday, the most magnificent sight we'd ever seen in our lives.
Yeah.
The doves were every colour in the rainbow.
Wow.
Absolutely gorgeous. They just let them out all over, and they were flying all around the church roof. You know, the big domes.
And did
it was magnificent sight.
Oh, they let them out indoors or outdoors?
Oh, outdoors. They were flying all around the dome of the church.
Wow.
Easter Sunday.
And did you happen to ask, Betty, how come the doves in Greece are multicoloured?
No,
in Ireland, they're black and white.
We were just mesmerised and thought how beautiful. We even took photographs. And if I remember rightly, I've got a video of them.
So will you send? It's probably on a videotape, is it?
It's on a videotape.
Yeah,
I'm having them all. I've got such a lot. Having them transferred. If I do find them, I'll send them on to you.
And wasn't there a famous story where the Pope's dove, the Pope, Pope Francis, released some doves?
Yeah,
you know, from.
The
dove was hardly out the window, and the predator got them.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh dear God! Well, no, these were beautiful, and it was a beautiful sunny day. You can imagine, but I'll never forget it. I can still see the dome of the roof, and it was all deep blue, different colours in tiles. You know, the roof. But this magnificent scene of all these beautiful doves, every colour under the sun.
And Joe Dunn, what do you think about that? The Pope released two pigeons, two doves.
No, well, he was ill informed as well, then, if that's the case, you know.
I know, but the Pope is infallible now.
That's Joe on the live line in the afternoon. And on Today with Philip Boucher Hayes, sports journalist Gavin Hamilton was taking a look at the career of one of the world's biggest soccer stars, Lionel Messi, as he says farewell to Barcelona.
Because Lionel Messi was out of contract this summer, he and his father, who acts as his agent, agreed a new contract with Barcelona. But the deal had to be part of Barcelona's budget that is then approved by the Spanish Liga. Because you have to be able to operate within a budget for the league to grant you a license to take part in the league. Now, Barcelona's financial problems are immense, which is one of the reasons they wanted to be part of this Super League that collapsed a few weeks ago. But Barcelona, because of their financial problems, could not come up with a budget that the Spanish league would agree to. So they have had to say to Lionel Messi, we can't afford to keep you, because it won't fit within our budget the Liga will allow. So they're putting the blame on the Spanish Liga for saying that the figures don't add up.
Messi was prepared to take a pay cut. Would that have made any difference to those budget figures?
Well, it seems to be. I mean, what Barcelona is saying this morning is that they agreed a two-year deal with Lionel Messi, but they wanted to pay him over 5 years, and that would have allowed them to stay within the budget. But La Liga would not allow them to sort of do that accounting trick. And so they've had to lose that option. But that was what Messi was prepared to do. He's got an absolute fortune in Barcelona. He's earned something like £300 million after tax in the last 4 years from Barcelona. So he was comfortable in lots of ways. And he would have happily taken a pay cut. But he clearly wasn't prepared to work for nothing, play for nothing, and that's been the problem.
Yeah. One wonders, and has anybody attempted to try and quantify what he is worth to Barcelona? Like, when the turnstiles are actually open, what does he bring in?
Well, he brings an enormous amount of money, but he also brings in an awful amount of money for the Spanish Liga, because they sell TV rights around the world. And it's a huge loss for the league and for Barcelona if he moves on and now plays for another club in another league.
But what is really going on here? Is this something of a Trojan horse being thrown at La Liga by Barcelona? You're going to lose the greatest footballer in the world to Spanish football if you don't wise up here. Is that what's really at play?
That was the message last night from Barcelona. And we thought maybe this is a negotiating tactic for them to tweak their rules to allow Barcelona's budgets to include Messi in their squad. That was the message we were getting last night, and there were suggestions that this was just a bluff from Barcelona to try and force La Liga to change tack. What's happened this morning is that Juan Laporta, the president of Barcelona, has given a press conference, and he's put the blame firmly on La Liga and said they wouldn't budge. I had a deal with Jorge Messi, Lionel Messi's father. That agreement was in place. He wanted to play, he wanted to stay in Barcelona, but La Liga would not allow it. So what Barcelona is saying, and Laporta is saying, is that it's all down to La Liga. They wouldn't budge, and now he is leaving.
So Barca's loss is to be, is it Paris Saint-Germain's game, do we think?
It looks likely. I mean, he will command a huge salary and signing on fee. So there are only really two clubs who can afford him. That's Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain. Manchester City yesterday signed Jack Grealish for a British world record £100 million. They're trying to sign Harry Kane. Whether they will also have the money to pay even more for Lionel Messi is questionable. So I think Paris Saint-Germain will be the favourites, especially as Mauricio Pochettino, their coach, is Argentinian and has a connection as a result with Messi. So I think PSG are in the driving seat at the moment, but things will probably move very quickly now.
Gavin Hamilton from Today with Philip Boucher-Hayes. And in the afternoon, Catherine Thomas was talking endorphin rushes and the invigoration of the cold shower in the company of Dr. Michael Mosley.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, we were chatting about cold showers. It was the last time I was on, I think. And whether or not they are good for you, I am a huge fan of them myself. Really only in the last sort of 6 or 7 months, you just lash the knob down to freezing cold. And it is the one way now that I only feel ready for the day when I've done it. Himself cannot fathom what I am at all. He thinks I am absolutely barmy. But anyway, we've gotten on to Dr. Michael Mosley, who has been doing a lot of research into this area and the benefits of cold water and the benefits they have on the body. So before I chat to Michael, here is a snippet of audio which he recorded for his BBC podcast, Just One Thing, and it's of him getting into a cold shower.
Right.
Michael, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Yeah, I've often wondered, you know, with the noises that I make, I probably have the neighbours talking next door with the noises that I make. Woo, woo, getting in and out of the shower. But I, as I said to it, I've been a convert in recent months. But let us know, what are the benefits?
Sure. So I think one of the things is it certainly wakes you up. What I do, I suspect like you do, is I get into a warm shower to start with, wash myself, and then I give myself a blast of cold water for the last 30 seconds to a minute. And I hyperventilate a bit. I scream a bit sometimes, or occasionally I sing, which rather puts my wife off.
Okay.
We both do it. The first thing I said is it kind of wakes you up. It stirs you and gets you going. There is evidence of impact on mood. And there's also evidence of the impact on the immune system. There was a study done in Holland a couple of years ago where they got 3,000 Dutch volunteers. And they either had to continue as normal or have a cold shower And they either did 30 seconds a minute or 90 seconds. And then they followed them over the course of the winter. And they found that those having the cold shower got less colds and other infections than those who were just having a warm shower. And the good news was it didn't have to be 90 seconds. It could just be 30 seconds.
But that
seemed
was,
to be enough.
Yeah, that was my thing, because I'd been looking at the Wim Hof method, and I had worked myself up to 3 minutes in a cold shower.
Whoa.
And then, yeah, and then I when I heard that actually the research stated or had found that you didn't need to stay in that long, I was kind of delighted, I won't lie.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing seems to be that you want to get to the point where you're feeling a bit comfortable and you're not screaming and you're not hyperventilating.
Mm.
For some people, I would recommend you start with something a bit shorter than that. So on the Just One Thing podcast, I talked to an expert about this and I got a volunteer to give it a go. And we recommend you start by just giving yourself a 10-second blast and build up from there.
Mm.
And anything, you know, between 30 seconds and a minute seems to be enough. It's just kind of waiting until things calm down a bit and you're not screaming away.
But I mean, when you look at the different areas that are being researched at the moment, as you talked about, reduced stress levels, higher levels of alertness, and then how it affects the mood as well. I mean, I know the research is ongoing in this area. Is there research being done in terms of immersing different body parts as opposed to your full body, you know, whether it's a head or a foot, and the benefits of not total cold water immersion, but various body parts?
Absolutely. So there's a group down in Portsmouth looking into this, and they're actually investigating whether you simply put your arm and your forearm into cold water, whether that will lead to benefits, and that would obviously be much easier for most people. And yeah, so it's a relatively new science, but there is evidence that when you get into cold water, you get this thing called a cold shock protein. Your body responds basically to the stress. It's a bit like going for a run. Runs are stressful, but it's the stress which gives you the benefit. And this cold shock protein seems to be good for the brain. And there is some evidence, at least in animals, that cold shock protein is also protective against things like dementia. So very much ongoing research. But the other thing I would say is cold showers are safe. But if you're going for a cold water swim, which a lot of people do, again, take it gradually and go with a friend or someone else, because there are, you know, if you have any heart condition, there is a risk that you'll hyperventilate and your blood pressure will shoot up.
Mm.
And I had an odd experience a couple of summers ago when I was swimming with my wife, and I just went completely blank. My wife said I came out of the water. I have no idea where I was or who I was. And I ended up in casualty where my memory came back, and it turned out that the cold water swim had induced something called transient global amnesia. In other words, all my memories were wiped.
Oh my God.
And it's rare, but it does happen, and you don't want that happening to you while you're, you know,
no,
by yourself.
And one listener asked if it might be related to facing fears, this cold water stuff.
Absolutely. I think there's an element of the challenge to it that you think, really, do I really want to do this? And then you do it, and then you overcome it, and then you feel rather pleased with yourself.
Mm.
So I'm sure there is a big element of that to it, along with, as I said, the sort of physiological response and possibly the production of these cold shock proteins, and possibly as well sort of things like endorphins and other feel-good hormones.
Mm-mm.
And there is some evidence for the production of those, and I said quite a lot of anecdotal evidence for the benefits in terms of mental health.
Mm. David says, I'm absolutely addicted. He started it. It's so scary, but it's such a buzz. And I think that's it for me as well. The one question that I did want to ask you is, when you get in from a lukewarm shower and you turn it cold, how cold does it have to be? Because do you need to go from 0 to 100? Because I have some mornings where I make it cold and then colder and colder and colder. And then I have some mornings where I'm feeling really brave and I just go from warm to freezing. So is there benefits to both, or do you just need to go for the full shock factor?
I think you go for what you what suits you. I don't think anyone's done the studies. Personally, I just go whack straight onto cold. And to be honest, you know, the water coming out of my tap isn't that cold. The other thing is, again, if you're cold water swimming, the advice seems to be do not spend any more time in the water than it's above zero. So if it's 8 degrees, for example, don't spend more than 8 minutes. If it's 10 degrees, don't spend more than 10 minutes. But in the shower, 30 seconds, I personally prefer going full on cold and having that good old gasp.
Dr. Michael Mosley with Catherine Thomas in the afternoon. And in the morning, Baz Ajmawi was very excited to meet one of his teenage idols, Noel Hogan, founding member of the Cranberries.
OK, I won't lie, getting very excited. OK, you can't have lived through the 90s without having heard of the music of the Cranberries, right? It was just such a massive part of my life. I think, you know, I lay on so many sitting room floors just listening to the Cranberries, Everything Dreams, Zombie. They were just omnipresent. They connected in some way with the massive US market and became mega, mega, mega rock stars very quickly. It was a long way from their roots in Limerick. Their first album, In the End, was released in 2019. That's their last album, In the End, was released in 2019 after the untimely and very sad death of Dolores O'Riordan, one of the iconic female Irish voices of our time, without doubt. Noel Hogan, guitarist with the Cranberries, joins me on the line this morning to talk about a retrospective book that's going to cover the band's entire career. Noel, good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
Noel, are you in Limerick?
I am. I'm sitting in my kitchen.
I like that. Straight away, I saw the number and I was like, he's in Limerick.
Yeah.
How down to earth is he? He's in Limerick. So tell me this. How is life at the moment?
Good, good. You know, like everybody else, we've been here since last year, kind of in lockdown along with everybody else. We've always lived here, you see. I know we've come and gone a lot, but home was always Limerick for us. So, when things kind of took a turn, 16 months ago, we just happened to be back. We were actually back from the Grammys about 2 or 3 weeks at that point, and we've just been here since.
See, that's when you slip out of just normal Limerick life. You just drop in at the Grammys. Do you get me?
Yeah.
It's just, listen, tell me firstly, I suppose, tell me about this book. It's not available yet, right? But people will have an opportunity to pre-order it, and there's some very special editions of it, aren't there?
That's right. Hot Press came to us last year with this idea. They had covered the band from the very beginning. I mean, you know, playing small clubs and bars where nobody knew who we were. So they had a massive catalogue of articles and interviews from us. And they had the idea that they'd like to put it all together in one book. They had done it previously, I think, with Phil Lennett. And they had, you know, it was quite popular. So they sent us that and we liked the look of it. And so what they've done is they've got two versions. It's a limited edition. It's a big, glossy, hardcover one. I think it's about 1,000 editions.
Deadly.
Of that. And that is going to be signed by us. And then there's the regular one, I think. I think it's about 5,000 of that, they were saying yesterday. So it's basically, it's got interviews from people we've worked with throughout the years, bands we would have toured with, as well as interviews from us, obviously, and then people in Limerick who we were involved with before we were known as well, in the kind of build-up to it all. So it really does cover everything up to the very end.
It's brilliant. Like, it sounds fantastic. Like, Noel, I'm trying to, like, did you guys have any clue about how big you were going to get and how quickly it was going to happen?
No. I mean, honestly, we were more surprised than anybody else. When you're a teenager, you start a band with all your other friends, and then you hope, you know, okay, we might get to play in Dublin, is kind of what we thought. You know, that would be success for us at that time. For it to explode and do, you know, what it did, none of us saw that coming. And even when we were in the middle of it, we genuinely didn't even kind of realise how big the whole thing was. It took a long time for that to sink in for us.
And as Noel points out, Dolores wasn't part of the original lineup of the Cranberries.
We had a guy who lived kind of around the corner from where I grew up.
I love that, around the corner. What age were you then?
About 18, I guess, 17 or 18. We literally, myself, Mike and Ferg, we bought instruments and started a band. We didn't know how to play. We'd never had a lesson. We had no idea what we were doing. But there was a really kind of vibrant music scene in Limerick at the time. So this other chap we met, Niall, was in another band that were pretty well known locally. And he was a drummer in that band. He was looking for a band that he could sing and write songs with. And I bumped into him in the street one day, and he became the singer for a while. And we played songs that he had written. That lasted about 6 months. And then Niall kind of wanted to focus more on the other band he was in. So he left. But we had kind of learned a little bit from that. And that was it. We kind of started writing our own stuff. And then...
Because you were writing, right? You
yeah,
wrote
I just started kind of towards the tail end of Niall being there. I'd started bringing in ideas. And then when Niall left, I kind of took over that job a bit more then. Until about another 6 months later, we just kept rehearsing. It was all instrumentals. And then... eventually, it was actually through Niall that Niall's girlfriend knew Dolores and introduced us.
So, do you remember seeing Dolores for the first time? Mm. Were you auditioning lots of singers, or were you?
No, Dolores is the only one who showed up. You know, yeah, Dolores was literally she came up. She was a very shy, quiet girl. Very nice, you know, just not the Dolores the world got to know at all. Like she was still in school, and she sang two songs for us, one her own. She did a Sinead O'Connor song. We played some stuff. We had instrumentals, and that was it. Just gave her a cassette with that had kind of an instrumental of Linger, basically the three of us just playing it. And that was the first song we wrote.
Do you remember the first time you kind of got that cranberry sound? Was that immediate, or was that something you nurtured or found?
It was pretty much immediate. I think it was very hard to hear when we were rehearsing, because we had very kind of a mixed bag of equipment that we borrowed from people, so you couldn't really hear things very well. But we scraped the money together for a demo pretty soon. We got four songs together. We went in, and when we did that first session, that's when you could hear the cranberry sound come together, and we can actually hear Dolores' voice better, how she started, the kind of layering that she became famous for, and it just started to glue together as the four of us then.
And Noel spoke about taking a break after the third hugely successful album and the toll the work was having on Dolores.
Yeah, we were meant to do, we had signed many contracts to do a very, very long tour, but we had literally had 6 years of album tour, and we just felt that we kind of weren't really able to do it. You know, just if you look back at that time, Dolores had become very, very thin, and you know, she was feeling immense pressure, and another tour would have just really taken out of everybody. And when the call was made, everybody was relieved. It was just a case that nobody wanted to be the one to kind of pull the plug on.
Yeah, there's that
pressure. What was so successful?
See, there must have been like the constant pressure of touring and the records. I think there's, you'll tell me, sorry, I think it's seven albums as the Cranberries. Was it too much?
It became easier, to be honest, because when we took that break that first time and realised, hold on a minute, we're actually in charge here. Because when you're young, and I think you're surrounded by record companies and managers that are a lot older than you and kind of give the impression that they know what's right for you, you believe that for a while. And then you go, well, I'm just not doing it. I just don't want to do it right now. And then they have no choice, really.
Yeah.
They, you know, and you start to realize, hold on a minute, I can actually control this. And we came back and we felt like we wanted to do it again, and we started to enjoy it more. And that's, if you look back, you'll notice we would do an album, do a smaller tour, and then take time off again. And we continued that until the very end.
Yeah. I want to be so respectful, and I don't want to in any way upset you. So after Dolores tragically passed away, the three of you sat down and you finished the last album.
Yeah, we had so much work done on it. The year before we finished the tour, and then Dolores was in New York, and I was in Europe for a while, and then I was back here. So between both places, I'd send her ideas, and Dolores was working on ideas she had in New York. And up until literally like a day or two before Dolores passed away, we were still sending ideas across to each other. So when you put that much work into it, and she was very excited about getting in to do this album, that it just, when we listen back to it, you think this would be such a shame to not finish this.
Yeah.
We're so close to the finish line on it. And we rang a producer that we've worked with for nearly all the albums, Stephen Street, and sent the stuff to Steve and see what he thought, because it's good to get an outside point of view as well to make sure you're not kind of, you know, too immersed in the thing. And Stephen loved it, but it was his suggestion that you should do it now and not leave time go, and you might not feel the same in a year or two. So that's what we did. It was the following April we went to London and spent a month or two finishing the album.
There's obviously therapy in that as well, I imagine,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. It distracted us, obviously, a little bit, but the hard part was you were listening to Dolores every day. Like, we had her vocals. So day one was definitely the weirdest, and the very last day where you realise that this is the last time that the three of us would play as the Cranberries together. That, like, we've been doing that since we were really just out of school, or even at school for Ferg still, and you know, we've known nothing else our entire lives. Even before we met Dolores, this was it for us. So you kind of felt that heaviness that day as well. But look, I mean, the reaction to the album was amazing. It was nominated for the Grammy, and we kind of felt, you know, we did the right thing.
Rightly so, rightly so.
Noel Hogan of the Cranberries with Baz Ajmawi in the morning. Now, in the wake of the Nadine Lott murder trial, Nolan Blackwell, Chief Executive Officer at the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, was talking to Philip Boucher-Hayes about domestic abuse and crimes against women in the home.
Person at the very centre of this trial was Nadine. Those were the words of Garda Superintendent Declan McCarthy speaking outside of court yesterday after Daniel Murta, aged 34, was convicted of the murder of Nadine Lott. The case had heard shocking details of the level of violence perpetrated against Nadine. Her injuries were so serious that she never regained consciousness after the attack in December of 2019 and died 3 days later at St Vincent's Hospital in Dublin. I'm joined by Nolan Blackwell, CEO of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. Good morning, Nolan. Thank you very much for speaking to us.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Tim.
Nolan, look, here we are once again. It's not something that is going to be new to you, but one wonders how on earth it is that you deal with once again asserting this fact that domestic violence, not all the time, but very often, will end up in the death of a woman.
Yeah, so first of all, Philip, if I can just say on behalf of all of us in the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre and, you know, so many people around the country, my heart goes out to Nadine Lott's daughter and to her family, and every sympathy to them. So, but you're right, this is at the extreme end of domestic violence, and it doesn't happen too often, but it happens too often, as it were. So it is the truth of our lives in our society in Ireland that domestic violence is still a far too hidden and far too endemic issue in our society. Too many people are affected by it across all the, you know, the genders, but it predominantly affects women across all age groups, across all classes. So there is nowhere that this is them. This is us. It's a society. And the trouble with domestic violence and abuse is that it happens so often in private. People can't see it. And people can be very worn down by the way in which domestic violence happens. And in this particular case, in some ways, it was a very unique case, but it was also a classic case of a man where the relationship was over. The evidence was clear. There are messages, text messages in the evidence in the trial that Nadine Lott told Daniel Murta that the relationship was over and he did not want to accept it. He did not want to lose the control. He wanted to be able to continue to control another human being. That is abusive behaviour. And the trouble with it is very often that it's kind of
people nearly believe them, you know, that in some ways, if somebody is the victim of an abusive relationship, it can be too easy to say, God, I have to put up with it in some ways, whereas there's all sorts of things that we have to do as a society to say, under no circumstances were the text messages, the WhatsApp messages, even acceptable, let alone the physical abuse that that Nadine Ladd had to suffer, ending in her death.
And Philip asked about the type of language used around the violence by Nadine's murderer.
Nolene, when he was initially questioned, he described what had happened as being a few slaps and a few digs. What does that say to you, or does it illustrate to you a wider mindset amongst certain men towards women and domestic violence?
Yeah, that's a really good point, because in a sense that is just saying it was only this, that there was some level at which the violence was acceptable, even the physical violence was acceptable. He didn't think sending those messages, telling her she was not to slip in terms of going out with other men, he didn't clearly see anything wrong with that, and then just saying a thump or a slap. Those are the kind of words that are very often used in relation to physical violence. And it is, again, that area where somebody thinks they are entitled to hit another human being and to hurt them and to minimise it in that particular way. So I think this is, again, something where we all have our part to play as well. Obviously, Daniel Murta, who has now been convicted, is the person responsible for this and the only person responsible for that murder. But there has to be, I think, maybe a look for all of us at saying there's no way in which anyone can accept somebody else saying, I just gave her a slap, or just, it was only a small thump, or, you know, I still, that kind of minimising has to stop now.
Is it important to you that the jury found that being intoxicated, having been drunk at the time, was in no way a mitigation?
Yeah, so the defence was that this should be reduced to manslaughter, because the defendant wasn't in full control of what he was doing. And the jury found, as a matter of fact, that was not the case after several hours. So that will vary from case to case. And of course, there are always those two options in a murder trial, that in some ways that it could be reduced on the basis of some kind of diminished responsibility. So here it is clear on these particular facts that the jury's finding was that this was somebody with the mentality who was able to do it, and that the proper conviction should be for murder. I think it's, you know, it really is important that these cases come to court at all, Philip, as well, you know, and just to maybe make the point here that the investigation of this case would not have been easy for the Gardaí. And God knows, we have lots to say about the justice system and the way in which it doesn't serve victims of intimate violence well. But in this case, it is clear that the Gardaí had a big job of work to do. The medics, of course, as well, had a very hard time in this case. But the Gardaí did their job, continued the investigation, brought it through the system, and that resulted in the outcome yesterday. And again, that's another part of reducing the incidence of intimate violence, sexual violence, domestic violence in our country. Those who carry it out have to be held to account for themselves, so that it doesn't happen, so that they don't do it again, but also for all the rest of us, so that we understand this is something that juries in this country, judges in this country take extremely seriously, and that our Gardaí take very seriously as well. It's part of, as well as reducing the tolerance of domestic violence, which is still far too big, as well as increasing the level of supports available to people so that they can escape, you know, as well as giving people the chance to talk about things, all of those things. But as well as that, we then have to say this is criminal behaviour. At this end, it's at the extreme end of criminal behaviour. But all domestic violence, all controlling abusive behaviour is criminal in this country, and people should just stop doing it.
And have you any ideas on how we change that mindset of tolerance towards domestic violence and just make it in all circumstances, in all its manifestations, something that is beyond the pale?
Yeah, and that's, so it's, of course, there's never just one answer. If there was one silver bullet, someone would have found it out by now. So it's going to be a whole lot of things. It is going to be that the Gardaí are trained and understand and can hear reports of this criminal behaviour when it happens. It is also, though, because, you know, abuse very often has a pattern that it happens over time. And we do need services like the helplines that are available for domestic violence, for sexual violence, where people can talk about things and understand that they are being abused and that they are not the problem, because a lot of manipulative behaviour demeans people to the extent that they kind of nearly forget that it's not their problem that this abuse is happening. But also to give people ways of leaving abusive situations, ways of dealing with intimate violence, ways of getting even things like, you know, alternative housing and that kind of thing. Now, that wasn't the case here. Nadine Lott had her own accommodation. But nonetheless, it's partly about ensuring that there are proper sanctions, there are proper penalties there for the crime. It's partly about making sure there are sufficient supports and services for people. It's also, though, Philip, about building an understanding of healthy relationships, which doesn't happen in our education programs, doesn't happen in our schools right now, so that people can grow up, girls and boys, people of all genders can grow up understanding it is absolutely unacceptable to abuse another human being in a relationship of any sort, and that trying to control or own another person is simply not normal. It's not right. And those kind of things we still have to implement, so that we try to change the way people think about this. Like, you know, 50 years ago, the truth is that people were told to go home and not bother the state, not bother the law, not, you know, and to be obedient if you were a woman to whoever, whatever man was in charge of you. So we've come a distance, but it's going to take committed and sustained approaches of our young people, our investigation prosecution services, our court systems. Three or four different things have to happen simultaneously. Yeah. And to the credit of, you know, the government at the moment, it's in the programme for government to advance this, and work is being done on that. This goes to prove again how urgent, how important that work is. And actually, it is really important, because if it is the case, and as far as we know it is, that one in five is a victim of domestic violence in this country, imagine if we could reduce that substantially, so that it was one in 50 or something. In that way, we would have a much better, healthier, safer society for all of us.
Nolene Blackwell, thank you very much for that. And as Nolene was saying, things have changed. There is help. There are supports and services out there. The Rape Crisis Centre's 24-hour helpline is 1-800-77-8888. The Women's Aid 24-hour helpline is 1-800-341-900. Men's Aid helpline 01-554-3811. If you missed any of those, just Google RTE helplines, rte.ie/helplines, and you'll get all of those contact details there.
Nolene Blackwell talking to Philip Boucher Hayes in the morning. And in the afternoon, Catherine Thomas was talking to self-titled yoga granny Eleanor Buckley.
Eleanor, how are you?
How are you, Catherine? Thank you so much for having me on the show.
So you are the headstanding granny?
Not yet headstanding, but on the way. The journey has started. I'm 3 weeks into it.
Okay.
Yes. So
where does one come up with a challenge like this? I mean, we all think our grannies and our nanas and our grandmothers are superwoman, but very few will go to the efforts of standing on their head.
Well, I suppose, firstly, I started yoga when I retired just 3 years ago, and I was lucky enough to get involved with the Sacred Body Studio with Fabiola and Gislin. They rang me about 6 weeks ago to know I had done the training with them, the teacher training with them, and they said when we're opening up, we'd be interested in you doing some classes. That wasn't my plan, Catherine. My plan really was, I got so interested in yoga, I wanted to learn a little bit more about it.
Okay.
So when I was linking in again with Fabiola and Gislin, I just said to Fabiola, do you think I could stand on my head? Because they were surprised at how I progressed over the COVID months. because I did it online. I was used to practice because of the training. So she said, yes. Well, I said, if I was to do it, I'd need a purpose. So I rang the Peter McCreary because I just have a great time for what he does. And they were opening an office in Cork. So that was a trigger for me to say, OK, go for it. And that's how it started. So I'm 3 weeks into the challenge.
Okay.
I'll be 67 in the 1st of September and I plan to be on my head.
And so I think it's fabulous that you're such a new convert to yoga as well. And what was it that made you decide to start yoga? Like, had you any interest in it before?
Well, vanity, posture.
Okay.
I just believe that when you get older, the one thing that's very aging is posture. And I'm anti-aging in any way I can prevent it naturally. And then I said, look, I have the free time now. I go into yoga. I had this idealistic view a few weeks and I'd have my posture correct.
Yes.
But you and I know it takes longer than that. It
takes a little bit of time. But what difference have you noticed with your flexibility and your mobility?
Oh, this is it. I mean, it's just amazing. I have freedom of movement. It's just, I suppose, it's confidence in my body. It's without knots. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like I would think of people who are having hip replacements. I know people and they're of my age group. And I keep saying it's not the hips are the problem, but the muscles around. I have a nursing background as well, Catherine. So I suppose, and then luckily enough, the Sacred Body Studio works with you in the development. In other words, you go in there, but they're very aware of correct alignment and they will be coming back to down to your big toe. You and I know the importance of the big toe in the yoga alignment.
Mm.
So it's just that I was surprised at how I developed, that I can now go fall forward in a wide open bend and my head will touch the ground. That didn't happen.
It's phenomenal
overnight.
Because I'm looking at you here on Instagram. Your Instagram handle is yogini_granny.
Yeah.
And the latest shots of you are in various locations around Cork. I know you put up a post every day somewhere different in Cork, but you have plenty of shots of you standing, trying to stand on your head in various different positions in various locations around Cork. I mean, what sort of reactions have you had from people?
Well, to be honest, my closest one would say to me, if I coach, come along and pick me up. I suppose it's back to me not worrying. I just so believe in what I'm doing. I believe in trying to raise funds for the Peter McCreary, but I also believe in trying to get the message across of flexibility and mobility. And it really hit home over the COVID when I saw older people in nursing homes.
Yeah.
And I really believe a lot of them, if they had a little bit more flexibility and mobility, would not need to go into nursing homes. Mm. And I suppose Fabiola just believes that I can. That's why she invited me into her classes and into her to offer classes in her Sacred Body Studio, because she feels I get the message across that you don't have to be 20, 30, 40.
Not at all.
No,
not at all.
To go on the mat. And I only went on the mat 3 years ago.
Yeah, it's incredible. So talk, yeah. I mean, I'm looking at you visually here. Talk to me about getting into the headstand just very quickly. What does it take? What does it entail?
Yes, and this is it, that I have to be, it's organically. In other words, that I have to develop my upper body strength, my core muscles before. And it's this development and the slow development of daily practice. And then realizing that your body will tell you when it's ready rather than you forcing your body. So that's the joy of yoga. There is no pain. There's no stress on muscles or joints. If I'm causing pain or stress in my joints, I'm doing it incorrectly. I'm not aligned correctly.
Mm.
So that's the massive benefit with yoga. And I know that, so that when I'm there practicing, I'm allowing my body to tell me when I need to pull back.
Mm.
But my body will also tell me when it's ready to lift up.
Mm.
So I was surprised last week when I was able to go from crow onto my head, Catherine. I was really surprised.
And what's the goal? What's the goal, Eleanor? Like, when you get up into a headstand, how long do you have to stay up there?
Well, four breaths is what we talk. We talk about effort and ease.
Yeah.
And when you go into ease and a pose, you're looking for four breaths anyway. This is the okay, if you can stay longer, great. But if you can achieve at ease, that's the word, with four breaths, then you have your pose.
Eleanor Buckley with Catherine Thomas in the afternoon. Now from the morning, Cork musician Anya Duffy has converted a donkey box into a camper van that also doubles as a stage base for her performances. She joined Baz Ajmawi on the line to tell him all about Duff Box.
I had the idea that I wanted to have my own little house, because that's also not easy for people in Ireland, another subject. So I started building a little house, went to the credit union, talked to some friends, and this came. But I had, so I have this now, it's got a little passive house with a green roof, delighted. And then I had some bits of materials, and I had a notion, how am I going to get back on the road? Am I going to release the single and get out there?
Whoa, whoa, now, for a second. Why did you want to build a house? You just wanted a house, did you?
Well, you know, there is a housing crisis, and
yeah,
it's
no,
not
I understand.
Easy.
Yeah.
I had been in Kinsale, and that's quite expensive now, and then I became single, and it's even more difficult. And
of course.
I needed to sort it out, so I did.
Yeah, brilliant.
So I was saying, I need to release my music now, and I want to be able to go out. And I was sitting on something, and I had figured out how to get it done, but I needed to release it. You know, when an idea is stuck in your head, you want to release it and write new stuff and get better when you're an artist. You want to make more, So.
And the pandemic was just stopping all that. It was just stopping you musically.
Yeah, because you kind of want to be able to tour when you release a single. Like, the information would want to say, oh, you know, Anya Duffy is releasing her single, or she's playing in Whelan's, or she's in wherever, in different countries, and then people can go, and that's all part of your income then. Like, touring's a huge part of it. It's a huge part of it. So, you know, I wasn't going to release and attempt putting on any gigs when things were dangerous.
Yeah.
And just when things started softening up, I was saying, okay, we're probably going to be able to be outside, and how am I going to figure this out? So I went on the internet, and I found a little old donkey box close by within the restrictions. And
a donkey box now?
Yeah, it's smaller than a horse box.
Right, I was wondering, sorry, I'm so South Dublin there, wasn't I?
You think they're cafes.
Right, yeah.
So I just got it, and it was light, and converted it, reinforced the back, made a camper and a stage, and said, right, here I go.
That is brilliant. Because I used to do outdoor theatre years ago, and you could, this could be a whole thing. Honestly, you could provide this for all the arts.
The crack was 90. I played at Garrettstown, and I did a proposal to the Department of Culture, Tourism, Sport, and I got a little grant. So I have another two gigs for this as part of the Cork Cocoa Pops event. So I'm playing again in August the 12th in Donnerail Arts Festival with the Duff Box, and down at Clonakilty Guitar Festival. And people had such fun in Garrettstown, all ages, and it was just, you know, it's special. It definitely does good for people. Like, I mean, if you look at the photos, you can see smiles. Like,
that's brilliant.
You know,
who doesn't
it was
love
amazing.
Music? Absolutely. Exactly. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. So tell me, there was an article in yesterday's Irish Examiner, right, where you were explaining why you had to erect a do not touch my knobs sign on your equipment. So why did you have to do that?
Okay. So I had played a couple of gigs, and there was, you know, people going up and touching the sound. Now, they're trying to help.
I think you dealt with it really, really well. I think
Thank
you dealt
you.
With it really, really well.
Anya Duffy with Baz Ajmawi in the morning. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.